Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, here with News Dissector Radio, an hour of programming, discussion, conversation, debate, and music on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network operates with no commercial support. If you want to join the conversation, you can call in to 888-874-4888. You can listen on the phone as well at 619-550-0869. So there's a way you can take part in this radio experiment, which is, seems to be developing a tremendous listener base, and I'm really thrilled to be part of it. Today on our program, we're going to talk with two old friends of mine who happen to be extremely knowledgeable about what's happening in South Africa. Mina Frenze is an executive producer at the South African Broadcasting Corporation. That's the BBC, the SABC of South Africa. She's a news person who knows what's going on and who can also help us understand what's behind what's going on. And with her, her new hubby, Ronnie Kazerels. Ronnie was a activist in the anti-apartheid movement in the ANC. He was involved deeply in the armed struggle against apartheid. He wrote a book called Armed and Dangerous. He then became, in the new undertaking, new dispensation, a minister of water and then a minister of intelligence. So he's been on the inside of the intelligence game. And today, on this day, when President Obama has delivered his address on national security, it'll be interesting to get Ronnie's reaction to it. Ronnie has also been part of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. In other words, he's not just a South African-oriented person, but he's concerned about human rights and justice the world over and has been very engrossed in the movement to support, in South Africa, to support Palestinian rights. So I thought we'd open with a song written by Mike Kohorst. He's not here because of the rain, the storms that have taken place here in New York all day. I wasn't even sure I'd be able to get here. But Polar Levine is still stuck downtown. But he's suggesting a song called The Blood. It's about a Jew agonizing over Israel's treatment of Palestinians. And we're going to play it for you now. And we're going to come back with Ronnie. Are you there?
Yep, Danny, I'm here.
Okay, and Amina.
And Amina
is there.
Her hubby, as you call me.
Yes.
Talking for her. She's sitting right next to me.
Let me just say that she...
First?
No, I think that we'll save the best for last, okay?
That's
Please
Amina.
Stay with us. Here's The Blood, Polarity 1.
Some kind of dues. And now you lie, but you told me you were fair. There's vengeance in your smile, and your love has just grown weak and bare. And now I no longer feel that we're bound. When I sleep, you call to me, Israel. When I sleep, you call to me, Israel. Through the years, we were the chosen few. Given the message, ah, look what hatred can do. But now your armies are chewing up the land, disowning your own brothers, while your valley is turning back to sand.
The Blood, Polarity 1. Hopefully he'll get here. He's been stuck downtown. I'm not sure if the subways have been disabled. I know the streets have been turned into a minor flood. Ronnie Casserole, Amina Frenzy were going to be with us in studio and actually tried to get here. Couldn't find any cabs. Couldn't find a way to move from the lower east side, rather around the UN, Midtown, up here to our studios on the Upper West Side. So they're with us on the telephone. I thought that song might be appropriate, Ronnie, as somebody who's taken on the Palestinian cause and has been criticized maybe by people who don't understand some of the parallels with South Africa and the struggle in South Africa. Why are you so deeply involved with the issues of Palestinian rights?
Well, just to first say, I can attest to the problems of the rain in this great big apple. We desperately tried to get to you by various means, and were driven back by the forces of nature, which aren't that strong here today. But, that's a very evocative, beautiful and sad song, evocative of so much in the human condition. And you talk about Palestine and South Africa. It's very, very simple, Danny. Any freedom fighter, anybody who served in the struggle for liberation of South Africa, not just me, who's been to Palestine, who's been to the occupied territories under Israeli rule, everybody says the same thing. It's deja vu. It's like going back down the road to an apartheid nightmare. It hits us all in the absolute same way. The checkpoints, the young soldiers toting their guns, the arrogance, the strutting, the sullen rows of the Palestinians, and then this awful segregation. I mean, in South Africa, you never had a whites-only road. They're Jewish-only roads serving the illegal settlements in the West Bank, as we well know.
I mean, one of the characteristics of apartheid in South Africa was a process called forced relocation. If you were in the wrong ethnic group or the ethnic group that was to be moved, you were physically relocated and taken off of your land, no matter how long you might have lived on it, and moved to usually a barren place to the point where 87% of the land in South Africa was in white hands, 13% in the hands of the black majority. You know, there's some parallels that really can't be talked away, can't be sort of kind of dismissed.
Yes, we never say it's the exact same thing, but there are such similarities. The dispossession of land which the indigenous people of South Africa suffered from, losing their land and then their rights, is exactly what happened to colonial people all over the world, including the Native Americans here, as we know. And the relocation factor in South Africa is precisely as you say. And, you know, we've seen this in Israel in very, very severe forms, obviously from 1948, which was based really ethnic cleansing and forcing people who had lived in that area for millennia. South Africa, the relocation to the so-called Bantustans, forcing black people, if they didn't have a job, if they weren't needed in the white parts on the farms or in the cities, they weren't wanted, and they would be kept as a reserve army of labor in those distant barren reserves, as in Indian reserves or reservations in South Africa, in the Americas.
I think, you know, a lot of people, just to break
they
in.
They came to be called Bantustan.
Yeah, let me just break in for a moment, because I don't think most Americans are aware of the fact that in the 1880s, a group of South Africans actually came to the United States and were given a tour of what were the emerging reservations, Native American reservations, as a model for what could be replicated in South Africa. That the United States is deeply complicit in all of this. This didn't just happen sort of by somebody getting a, you know, kind of a lightning strike one day.
It happened that way. They learned from each other. In fact, they went to Canada as well, and were very taken up with what they saw. And clearly the term reservation was one which was immediately co-opted by the colonialists of the time in southern Africa. It was under the actual apartheid system, which coincidentally comes into being through White's only election in May 1948, within weeks of Israel's unilateral declaration of independence. And then the more extreme form of control under the Afrikaner minority amongst the whites, who are even more extreme than the previous colonial rule, bringing in the very extreme forms of race laws and declare that there's going to be Bantustans and Bantu education for the children. They didn't like the fact that in the previous dispensation, under benign, in quotes, type of British inheritance, there was attempts to at least apportion of black people to give them better education. And the churches were very instrumental in that. I'm talking about British, Scottish, German and French and so on, tried to actually develop a higher level of education, which did pay off to some degree with the emergence in the 19th century of the black African elite. The Afrikaners said there's no place for blacks in white society. They must forever be hewers of wood and drawers of water. For Wood, who became the Prime Minister, said there's no use teaching these black kids mathematics. They're never going to need to use it. So, you know, I'm just stressing here the more extreme form.
But in the meantime, you know, you mentioned the parallel. I hadn't thought about this, how apartheid and Israel both came into being in the same year, 1948.
That's it, yeah.
But the Zionist movement in Israel saw itself as a national liberation movement, much in the same way, using the terms that the movements in Africa, anti-colonial movements, use national liberation. And, you know, they saw themselves as creating in the Middle East, the, you know, a Jewish state that would be under the control of, you know, kind of a biblically sanctioned effort to return to land that had been theirs.
Yeah. You know, the coincidences don't stop, because Afrikaner nationalism, they took the Bible to heart, much the way that pilgrims and pioneers of white civilization did throughout history. And they loved the Old Testament and the fact that they regarded themselves, like the ancient Hebrews or Israelites, as a chosen people and had this covenant with their God to deliver them from the hands of the enemies and win battles in the colonial struggles against the indigenous black people. So they built up a very strong mythology that way, and were clearly very attracted to the Zionist model. You see what the two have in common, which you don't find very often. You find, of course, the colonial racist model, but in this there's the very ethnic factor. So it's an ethnicity issue for Israel, that the chosen people, the Jews, and I'm Jewish, of course, so people mustn't call me anti-Semitic, or self-hating for that matter. I'm concerned about people who remove the rights from others, yeah, and say it's just themselves.
Just jumping in here.
That's
jumping
my understanding of the inheritance that I've had from my parentage. But it's the ethnicity factor. So they said, we Afrikaners, ethnically, we want our state. And this, of course, is where Israel, where everything has gone wrong from the start. Instead of a country, which South Africa has now become, unified, equal rights for everybody as equal citizens.
Let me jump in here for a second and welcome Amina Frenzy to the program.
Just passing the phone to
okay.
her.
Okay, thank you. That was quite brilliant. Amina is a journalist and someone I've known for many years and covering South Africa. But the other night, we were at an event together, and there was a discussion there of part of the whole apartheid system which is, you know, called racial classification laws, where people were classified about their race. You know, if you were Japanese, you were honorary white. If you were Chinese, you were black. They had rules and regulations. How did that affect you, Amina, growing up in white South Africa?
I was born in Cape Town, probably one of the most beautiful parts of South Africa, overlooking Robben Island, the infamous, where Mr. Nelson Mandela and other political prisoners were incarcerated. So growing up in that beauty, and all of a sudden you find that everything is segregated. You know, you go to town, you find the park benches are segregated, the toilets are segregated, the beaches are segregated, the trains and the buses are segregated. I wouldn't have any of that. I think from an early age, before I was even able to articulate or understand, have a full understanding of what was happening, I started beating up the kids who played in the best parks. The best parks were reserved for little white children. I'm classified as something called Malay or colored or something like that, which is a kind of a second-class citizen. So I couldn't play in a park, for example, which had, let's say, 10 of the best pieces of sports equipment. Maybe we had two in our park, and the grass was not that green. So what would I do as a little kid? You know, I wanted the best, toys. And we would drag kids off the swings and chase them home and say,
tell us about the pencil test and the nose measurements that were often used to classify people racially.
From the older listeners, those who will remember what happened in Nazi Germany, where people were classified and tested whether they were Jewish or not. The angle of the nose was measured in Nazi Germany. And a couple of other things. Now, the architects of apartheid studied a national socialism in probably the 30s, 1930s, etc., in Germany, and came back, with a string of things, and they tried to implement it. So, for example, if you would look at myself, I'm relatively fair-skinned, and it's very difficult to classify me, for example, so they wouldn't know where I fitted in. But if a baby would be found abandoned, a child would be found abandoned, and they don't know the origin of the child, they would test where the child comes from. They would put a pencil through the hair of the child, and if the pencil falls out, in other words, if it had straight hair, like, let's say, Japanese hair or something like that, the child would be classified white. If the pencil stuck, you know, like your hair would be a little bit more curly, the child would be classified colored or black. They would also look at the skin tones and the skin colors and do a bottom-pinching test. I think if you pinch a black baby's bottom, it stays purple. Apparently, it stays purple longer or something like that. But they would also, in later years, when people asked for classification or contested what they were classified as, they would look at the length of your fingernails. And if your fingernails were, like, shorter, you're likely to be classified anything other than white. So there were all these classification measures, including nose measurements as well.
So this is part of our...
This person would have a white skin, but her nose is too flat, so therefore she cannot be white. She has to be classified colored or something else. And this is what they did to so many people.
So this is the legacy, if you will, that the new South Africa has had to confront and the challenge of confronting it. There's a new category in South Africa that I've heard about called the Born Freeze.
Yes.
These are kids that have been born since Mandela was released from prison, since the end of apartheid. What kind of South Africa are they inheriting?
The kind of South Africa that they are inheriting are, you know, free freedom of movement, freedom of expression, freedom to live where they choose and where they can afford, freedom to go to school where they can, freedom to go to whatever beach they choose to. These are all things that didn't happen in the past. So freedom to be wherever you want to be whatever you want to be, also, considering what you can afford, of course. We may be politically, racially liberated and free and so on, but there's a whole lot of economic challenges which are facing us.
Yeah, I want to get
levels of poverty and unemployment, and there's a whole lot of economic inequality which is a worrying factor for us.
I want to get into that in a second, but I don't want to jump over the struggle. You know, today when you look at South Africa, you know, things may be smooth. I mean, there's crime, there's unemployment, there's lots of problems, but it doesn't rise to the level that it did before, and so people tend to move on, and at least in the United States, and that's sort of no longer a problem. We fixed that, that's over. And in fact, without really appreciating what it took to make that change, that didn't just happen, you know, when you woke up one morning. There was a lot of people who struggled and died and fought for it. And Ronnie, you were part of that struggle. What was the, how did that struggle organize itself, and how long did it take, in a way, to achieve, you know, even the status, the liberation that you did?
Well, apartheid became policy in 1948, and I think from there people started resisting. But prior to that, there was already resistance to some of the apartheid land measures, the Land Act, for example. You know, where
I wonder if
were robbed of their livelihood. But hold on, let me put through. You want to speak to Ronnie?
Yes, I'd like to speak to Ronnie, because Ronnie has written a book. At one point, you were called armed and dangerous. You were seen as part of this Moscow-backed armed struggle revolution that had, you know, in the same way that we have an incredible amount of paranoia here around national security issues, the white South Africans probably had more. They saw the country being threatened by this you know, onslaught from, you know, the Soviet Union and everywhere else, and that you were an agent of a foreign power. Wasn't that how you were presented?
Well, not just me, but all opposition. Initially, it's in Afrikaans, it's Swart Gevaar, the Black Peril. And then with the onset of the Cold War, they began to think, oh, you know, there's another way of getting support from the United States and Western Europe, the Red Peril, you see. And, of course, by 1960, when there were no avenues left for peaceful change, liberation movements, ANC, Pan-Africanist Congress, they were all banned. People were outlawed as well, restricted, banished, imprisoned, massacres like Sharpeville. There was no further way forward. And under the Mandela leadership, it was a decision to embark on armed struggle, as the Americans did against British and English colonial rule in the War of Independence. Yeah, and as we well know, people who were striving for national independence and liberation from colonialism throughout that period, throughout Africa and elsewhere, basically got support, material assistance, military training, etc., from socialist countries like the Soviet Union.
And Sweden.
And on that basis, they applied this allegation.
But you know, that must have been very difficult, to be thrown into exile, forced into exile, to have to regroup, to organize, you know, a military response, to fight against a far superior army backed by all the Western countries in many ways, with the latest weapons, including with weapons supplied by Israel.
Absolutely, nuclear weapons from Israel. Yeah.
So, you know,
from that point, Danny, it took just under 30 years. When we talk about it now, and looking back in history, three decades doesn't sound fantastically long. But when you're in the middle of those decades and you're fighting a very bloody struggle, people going to prison, people being tortured, people being executed, apartheid agents and the military invading neighboring states where we had gathered for safety and to regroup, Even as far afield as Paris, where an ANC representative, Dulcie September, was assassinated, Ruth First in Maputo, ANC office bombed in London, etc. You can imagine the mayhem going on in the neighbouring states, in places like Angola, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, etc. But we stuck to it. It was a question of never say die, because ours was a just struggle, just like the American struggle against the English crown. And I say that because obviously I'm here and it comes to mind, but so it should invoke in American people the memory of where they've come from. You see, it's not different. And we stuck to our guns, literally, metaphorically, saw it through. We believed that in the end we would win. Because of the justice of the struggle, we made sure we kept the moral high ground. We didn't go for terrorism, which I would define and we defined as violence against non-combatants or indiscriminate killing of civilians. You lose the moral ground that way. And it's morally wrong anyway. We were very careful with that, and in the process we managed to win, or the black struggle managed to win a lot of white people who crossed over and joined. Small numbers, but sufficient to call alive to the racist myth that it was a struggle between blacks backed by the reds on the one side and the whites who had to stay unified together in their lager. So 30 years on, and we broke the back of white repression, and they sued for talks and negotiations. The moment that happened, we were very ready to put the guns away and to get involved in making change the peaceful way.
So, you know, this is a saga that, you know, people who have followed it here, like myself, you know well, or at least know a lot about, not everything, obviously. But, you know, it's also, you're making a parallel as a South African to the American Revolution. It's amazing how many Americans don't remember that this country came into being as a result of a bloody war and a struggle with the French supporting, General Washington's army. You know, this was not something that, is part of our history. And then we find ourselves in many conflicts around the world, siding with the very people who are fighting against people who are trying to make change, who are supporting the status quo.
This is a treachery in terms of the American legacy. How many countries, I mean, the ANC, we've got the African National Congress, you know, the influence and the respect that people of the colonies in Africa and elsewhere had for the freedoms of the French Revolution and then the Great American Revolution. And I think America's lost that to a tremendous degree, because instead of standing against what the older colonial powers that it once had fought, instead of taking a mantle of freedom and remaining that way, America came, in my opinion, and I think certainly in history, historic perspective and opinion, from the post-Second World War, increasingly to take the place of former colonial powers in a new form.
I would like to, you know, take up some of those issues and also look at what's happening in the new South Africa, some of the conflicts and contradictions there as well that I know you've been very outspoken about, and we need to really understand as well, because everything is not, you know, shall we say, peachy keen in South Africa. There are a lot of challenges there that we should try to know about. So we're going to be back in a minute with more with Ronnie Castrels, Amina Frenzy. Hopefully your calls, if you'd like to make any, to 888-874-4888. I'm Danny Schechter. Stay with me.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
Smooth. world in a minute.
Morning Examiner station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does this speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's...
Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's out the door. It's the media war that we're fighting here on PRN at News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here with Ronnie Kasrils, Amina Frenzy on the phone. Couldn't get to the studio because of the torrential rains that rocked New York City this afternoon. And, you know, we were talking about a little bit of the history of South Africa, some of the parallels between South Africa and Israel, and the conflict that continues in South Africa to this day. I mean, you won the fight against apartheid. You've won a democratic government. People have the right to vote, which they never had before. But you've also found yourselves dealing with an economic crisis, a situation of mounting inequality, growing poverty, and a great deal of difficulty with a lot of corruption thrown in to boot. How do you see the new South Africa today, Ronnie?
Well, we're not quite out of our teens. Next year we'll be 20. It's a very, very short period in the history of any country. And we've had a huge legacy which we're still having to overcome, not just the 42 years of apartheid, but 3.5 centuries of racist colonial rule. Not that we say that all the problems stem from that. We take up and have to the challenges that we are faced with now. And I speak as someone who's been in government and also someone who is, in a democracy like ours, able to be critical of our government. The corruption factor is something which we didn't imagine would take hold to the extent that it has. I think this is clearly a problem with any emergent country. We've seen this all over the world, but at the same time also with very older democracies. I'm not needing to bring in totalitarian regimes. So, you know, you've got your problems of corruption here in the States. We read about it in the Washington Post and the New York Times. Virtually every other day, there's graft and corruption that's taken place, and this happens in Europe as well. So there is a factor there.
But I'm not trying to point the finger, you know, at South Africa. But you know, this was a struggle that really, you know, flew a banner of high morality.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was coming to make the point that what surprised us is that ours was a very high level moral struggle of integrity, of service to our people, etc. Hello?
I don't know. Did we lose you? I don't know. I hear you clearly. Continue. Let's see.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. There's some problem with the phone, but let's try to keep going.
Okay, Danny, do I take it that we're on air with
Yes,
you?
We are. You are
okay.
On the air.
Sudden interruption. So we come to power. There was compromise to a great degree to avoid a racist civil war. We made compromises with the economic system, with the way South Africa run as we came to assume political office. And I would say because we failed in that compromise situation to really grips with the heart of the economy.
Ronnie, let me just ask our person here to try to call you back. Can we do that?
Sorry?
Because we're going to call you back because we're getting some sort of static on this line.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe it's the rain. Maybe it's the water. Maybe it's your enemies hacking into the phone line. I don't know what it is.
Someone's plumbing.
I don't know. Okay. We'll call you right back. We're listening to Ronnie Kasrill. Ronnie was a former minister of intelligence in the South African government. He's been a soldier and an activist and a best-selling author. His book Armed and Dangerous, a book that he's written about Eleanor, his ex-wife, have really been acclaimed. He's got a tremendous style as a writer and as a speaker, as you're listening. And so I was really thrilled, since they're in New York, to have them on the program to talk to us a little bit about some of the issues in South Africa. We all, of course, in New York, were so thrilled when Nelson Mandela came here in 1990. Yankee Stadium was packed. There was tremendous turnouts to events to support and act in solidarity with Mandela and with the South African government. But now Mandela is out of office. Jacob Zuma is in office. And we're going to try to go back now to Ronnie to just give us a feel on what's happening, because you've been very outspoken and critical about certain developments there as well. You're not an apologist by any means.
Hi, Danny. Still got a really bad line. I don't know if you're hearing me okay.
Yeah, I am hearing you.
I can't hear you. No, there's too much noise.
You can't hear me. All right. Tell you what, Ronnie. Hello.
Yeah.
Can you
Hello.
Just hang on the phone for a minute? We have a slight intervention and we'll come right back to you, okay? Please stay there. I'll be right back. Let's say hello to Stephanie. Stephanie?
Yes, hi, Danny.
Stephanie has been in the rain, in the storm, in the Hudson River at the Intrepid Aircraft Carrier Museum, where a group of people were planning for quite a while to protest against Henry Kissinger receiving a democracy award. And you're there now. What's happening?
Well, we're not there yet. We're Intrepid also. We're trying to get over there. We left quite a while ago, and we can't get a cab. And so we're walking there, and we're not there yet.
Okay, so...
And we're looking for a cab as we're walking.
Okay, well, tell us what the protest was about, and then we're going to have to leave you for now.
Okay, well, Henry Kissinger, who has committed countless crimes throughout his life and is responsible for the deaths of millions of people, is getting a Freedom Award at the Intrepid, a fundraiser for the Intrepid Museum. And he certainly doesn't deserve any Freedom Awards. So we're going to be outside protesting while the guests arrive for cocktails and dinner.
Are you wet?
It's starting to rain again, so I think we'll be wet very soon.
Okay. Well, look, we wish you luck. Thank you for joining us and giving us an update on all of this.
And I'm sure
we'll hear more about it. Thank you, Stephanie. Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Back to Ronnie. Are you there? Can we try him again? Okay. We're having some phone problems here. Maybe it's storm related. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's Danny related. I can't say. But, you know, I made arrangements to try to speak to these people, thinking there'd be a big demonstration going on. It would be interesting to hear from them on the front lines, questioning, you know, challenging war crimes, challenging Henry Kissinger here in New York. But the rains intervened. On every front, preventing Ronnie, our guest, and Amina, our guest, from coming to the studio, and preventing Pilar Levine from joining me as a co-host. Now
we're trying to get on back on track.
Okay, Ronnie, thank you so much. We just took a little brief deviation because there was a demonstration taking place at the Intrepid Museum. That's an aircraft carrier on the Hudson River.
I've seen it.
It was a big award for promotion of democracy to Henry Kissinger.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. And all these people are turning out, different organizations, happy with Kissinger's record. But like you, they couldn't find the cab to get over there. And so they're walking, and the rain has started up again. So,
well, you know, Danny, it says something about the intrepidness of people who raise voice and struggle for a just cause. And I want to quickly say this, given the interruptions we've had, and I'm saying it on behalf of Amina myself, that you're one of those And the things that you've done for South Africa over the years are so appreciated. And it's, of course, it's not just you, but you've been absolutely outstanding. And it gives us the chance to point out the wonderful solidarity we had from the kind of people who were involved in the demonstration today, who you referred to, in the anti-apartheid struggle to bring about South Africa's freedom. We had this fourth echelon in our struggle. We talked about four pillars of struggle. And that echelon, or that pillar, was the international anti-apartheid movement, which brought about the isolation of South Africa through boycott, through sanctions, through solidarity, which inspired the oppressed people. The other three were the mass political struggle of our people, the underground struggle with the spread of leaflets and information, and, of course, armed action, which reinforced and inspired that struggle. So I wanted to quickly get that in.
I really appreciate that. And you know, of course, there's another element also, song. You know, songs like Sun City, Artists Against Apartheid, the various concerts of artists.
Free Nelson Mandela.
Free Nelson Mandela, you know, has been really a powerful way in which cultural activists, cultural artists stood up against apartheid also and challenged what was going on and supported the cultural boycott of South Africa.
Exactly.
So this wasn't, this was something that was a mass movement. Now today South Africa is sort of seems to be on its own, and there's a lot of concern there. And you've been one of the people, former government ministers, who's not afraid to speak out. I'm sure some of your, you know, comrades and people you worked with question why you're so critical. You know, I mean, there's a defensiveness that often accompanies people in power. They don't like criticism necessarily, and they feel concerned. But, you know, here we've had a situation where miners were gunned down during a strike by the police at Marikana. And there's been a seemingly lack of sensitivity to all of these scandals that are taking place as poverty in the country intensifies. And this is something should be concerning to everyone, but it is concerning to you and to Amina. Tell me your concerns about it. What do you think can be done about it?
Well, part of what's being done is to raise people's voices, to point out to the government that we're not going to tolerate these abuses of our rights. We've got a wonderful constitution, a Bill of Rights. Our police ought to be under control. They ought to be serving the people and protecting the people. Our economy must be working for our people. And when it doesn't, and this is why I was making that point, you know, when you just have a political change and you don't go deeply enough to get that economic change, then things are going to go awry. And with it, you will find that you're faced with graft and corruption and cronyism, etc. And it's that factor that is coming to the fore to such a degree. But civil society in South Africa is very resilient. It takes its pages out of the book of the anti-apartheid struggle, both internationally and within South Africa itself. And one sees this in our trade union movement, in the media. Of course, the aspects of the media are very pro, not the government, but certainly pro capitalism as such, and support for so-called Western civilization and even the aggressive wars. But we've got very good combative journalists, people like yourself there, Danny, as you well know. The churches and religious groups have been outstanding. Amina and I were very involved in a Right to Know campaign against government legislation, which was creating greater secrecy in terms of what government was up to. And we could see this was a cover-up for a lot of the graft and corruption. And the protests actually forced the government to make huge concessions.
That's an interesting
legislation, you see.
That's an interesting parallel to what's going on here, where we discovered recently that the government tapped into the phones of the Associated Press and in search of information about leaks of various kinds. And that leads to a certain amount of paranoia. on the part of, it certainly did in the case of Richard Nixon. It has on the part of a lot of governments trying to control information and keep the public, you know, kind of ignorant about a lot of what's going on. And there's been a lot of pushback to that, not only from journalists, but from citizens groups who are very upset about it. We still don't know. You know, we've had a big scandal here about the revenue service, the Internal Revenue Service going after the Tea Party. But apparently it wasn't just the Tea Party. There were a lot of other organizations, opposition groups, left groups, that were also targeted. None of that has been covered yet. So our press can be very selective. And, you know, that's a difficulty. You know, I worked inside major media here at ABC News, at CNN, at CNBC. And I know the kinds of pressures that are often brought to bear, you know, on journalism. It's not really quite... you know, the kind of overt censorship that we had in South Africa, you know, where Amina will remember this, you know, a record by Stevie Wonder was scratched in the library. It wouldn't be played. Other people were on, you know, kind of the list of people not to be mentioned. Mandela's own photograph couldn't be seen for years when he was in prison. Yeah. So there was blatant censorship. But here we have a kind of self-censorship where people get along by going along, you know, with practices that really are questionable.
And the most frightening aspect is, you see, that tends, as with much of the media, to serve the interests of the corporates who own the media generally. And this is the problem we're having in the world, and it affects South Africa as to some of the problems you're pointing out. You know, I think America's made famous, protest movement in America perhaps has made famous the question of the 1%, and of course we have that in South Africa. And you're talking about the media, we see that the media is actually the voice in the main of that 1% of the corporate.
And even sometimes when it becomes, you know, public broadcasting, there's still, instead of corporate overlords, there are often, you know, government-influenced overlords who are very nervous, let's say, very anxious about any criticisms that might emanate. And as a result, they tend to muzzle programming and the like. Amina maybe can join us on this for a minute.
Yes, you know, we're not on a loudspeaker, so she's sitting smiling at me, trying to follow. I'm going to pass this over to her now.
Oh, great.
And her particular field. Thank you.
It's a little clumsy here. There's one phone on the other end. We have two guests who were supposed to be in the studio, couldn't get here because of the rain. So the conversation is a little bit stilted, is a little more difficult. But Amina, you work in public broadcasting. You work for a state broadcaster for many years, was rigidly controlled by the government. Literally, the prime minister would determine, you know, what went on the evening news. Now you have a democratic media, but there's also these pressures towards a kind of top-down commandism. Do you find that? Do you have to battle those battles sometimes?
Well, it affects everyone as far as public broadcasting or right to access information is concerned. There's some interference. Just to go take us back a little bit, it was a state broadcast. I was involved in transformation, became a public broadcaster, and we put a board in place and said editorial independence and arm's length or non-interference by members of the board. And that happened for a number of years. Currently, I can't say that is still the case, unfortunately and regrettably. There's sort of a hand of government, you know, wanting to play a role, or some members of government, ministers' communication, perhaps, you know, influencing the appointments of some people at the broadcaster, and that is most unfortunate and a very sad turn of events, and we can't continue like that. There's certainly an intolerance of that kind of interference, which has resulted in the entire board of the South African Broadcasting Corporation resigning. We currently have an interim board in place to try and run it on an interim basis, so that, you know, new board members can be elected and so on. But the members who will make themselves available for election to the board, they're wary of this hand of interference. from certain quarters. But although we are called a public broadcast, about 80% of the revenue comes from commercials, and the state has only a 3% financial stakehold in the broadcaster, but it has a lot more say, as you can imagine. So not a very happy situation. But that is as far as public broadcasting is concerned. We have a relatively free media. We do have freedom of expression. Of course, individual heads of news and things like that are probably treading carefully. I speak out, unfortunately, and it comes at a price. So it's a tricky situation.
Well, you know, if I was the king, you would be the queen, you know, certainly of broadcasting in South Africa, but I'm not, and there is no king. There is, however, a public service ethic, and a lot of journalists are trying in good conscience to serve the public. You certainly have in South Africa some very feisty newspaper reporters and publications, the Mail and Guardian.
And we have on the newspaper, on the print side, we have the South African Press Council, which is a wonderful body. If people want to check it out on the website, we just have new members. We have judges and journalists and all kinds of people involved. I'm on the Press Council as well. And one of the things we would be dealing with, for example, for those people who live in the New York area and those who read the New York Times, for example, on page 2, there's a place for corrections. And there's on average at least 10 or 11 or 12 corrections on a daily basis. These would be some of the things that the Press Council, like myself and other members, would be dealing with.
So that's the kind of...
These would be complaints from the public, ethically incorrect, you know, those kinds of things. But it seems like the New York Times is taking a proactive role. And some of our newspapers do as well, but sometimes they don't. But they're very serious cases.
There's also a secrecy law being proposed now by the government, which could actually dampen the freedom of information as a whole.
Oh, absolutely. We have vigorously opposed it. In fact, we have marched on the Constitutional Court and on Parliament, myself and husband, Ronald. We marched together, although he was in Parliament before and a minister before, as you know. He himself has marched on Parliament as well, opposing this, what we call the secrecy bill. It has changed quite a lot. We have, I think, the Right to Know campaign, which is a big coalition of over 400 organizations opposing it. Included in there is the South African National Editors Forum and other that I'm a member of and on the executive of and a number of other bodies as well. So we're opposing that. A number of changes have been made since, and where it is currently is that it's gone through the various parliamentary processes and et cetera. Currently, we would like the president to take it to the Constitutional Court before he actually passes it, because it won't stand up to our very progressive constitution. It is against at least a couple of sections of our constitution regarding freedom of expression and freedom of speech.
Their constitution is something we could use in our country, because
we're
in a situation where claims of national security are being used to override freedom of the press and freedom of expression. It's a very worrisome situation today.
Yes, recent cases of your AP reporters and I think Fox reporters, where the phone records have just been, you know.
I've experienced CIA kind of interference or monitoring of my work as a journalist in London years ago. When I worked with Ramparts magazine, I got some documents from the Freedom of Information through the Freedom of Information Act that showed that they, in fact, were monitoring what I was doing. So these are real problems in your country and in ours. And I'm really so happy that you and Ronnie Kasrolls took time out this afternoon, this rainy afternoon here in New York, to share some of your concerns with us and your feelings with us. Ronnie is working on a new edition of his book, Armed and Dangerous, which I really recommend when it comes out. It's the original version is brilliant, and I'm sure this new version will be even more up-to-date and interesting. And thank you so much, Amina, for joining us. You're one of my dearest and oldest colleagues, if you will, in South Africa, and I'm really proud that you could be on the show this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Danny, and also on behalf of Ronald, you know, it's like people like yourself, courageous voices like yourself that continue to take a stand, and it comes at a price, and say no to injustice, and say no to abuse.
Now I have to say no to you because we're running out of time rapidly.
Right.
I just want to say you can write to me at Media Channel, Danny at MediaChannel.org. Please look at MediaChannel.org, our newly revised website. I have a piece up on AlJazeera.com, a new piece about filmmaking, whether making films make change. That's up today on the Al Jazeera website. You might want to check that out. Please write to us and get involved. The actual URL, the podcast of this show, will be on my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow morning, so you can share it with friends if you found it illuminating, as I certainly have. Thank you again for being here. Thank you, Heather, for being at the board. And thank you to the gods for letting me get through the rains to come and be with you this afternoon.
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.